one of these. These are for your note-taking ease. We hope that that'll make it a little bit easier for you. There's also a coupon on the back, and you'll have noticed on the table that we have some materials put out. Our goal is for this not to be an infomercial for the materials that we put out, but really rather to give you kind of an idea of the heart behind why we ended up writing this curriculum that we've written. And we want you to have a sense of what we've come through. Your experience has probably been similar. Richard and I worked together for years, and while we were working together, we figured out pretty quickly that the communicants class models that we had grown up with had weaknesses. And in one case, then we had a kind of a threshold set, and when they get to a certain age, then we'll put them all into a communicants class. That's a pretty common model in our world. And what we found was that, and a lot of times, then there were students that were ready well before that to join the church, to begin to take the sacraments, and we were withholding from them the means of grace because they had not yet reached this artificial threshold that we had set for them. On the other hand, then there were students that felt pressured to join the church because all of their classmates were, but they weren't ready yet. And so we began to brainstorm and say, what are some of the problems that we see? What are some of the solutions that we could offer if we could kind of start from scratch? And that's sort of the heart behind what we've done and what we're here to present to you all this morning. So what we want to do is talk to you about a kind of a top 10 list that we figured with a top 10 list, and even if you think we stink, then you'll still know how long you're going to have to suffer through it. And there's a threshold in sight. So we thought we'd give you a top 10 reconsiderations for effective communicants classes. And Richard's going to take the first one for us.
We thought we'd actually do tag team wrestling, so I hope you can live with that. Two big guys wrestling. We really felt like pastoral leadership in developing communicants classes and carrying them out is an essential part of what needs to happen as your children are ready to make professions of faith and to become members of the church and have a meaningful church membership experience. You know, the scriptures call us to disciple our children and to train them and to teach them in such a way that they walk with Christ and that they have the faith that we have. So we think that the pastoral leadership is key. You know, one of the key things that you do as a pastor is shepherd your flock. And so the questions came to us as we were struggling with what to do with this group of kids that we needed to bring into the church. We needed to be certain of their walk with Christ. Was how do we effectively lead them and shepherd their families? With students, the stakes are pretty high. You know, you think about it. You've got a 10-year-old, 11-year-old who has been participating in the life of the church, and all of a sudden he is put into a class, whether it comes in Sunday school or whether it comes in some sort of special pastor's class or something, and he is exposed to the church. Think about the things that most students are exposed to. You know, who are their peers? What are their peers learning? Who are their heroes? What are the influences that TV and that culture have? What's the influence of the family? We felt like pastoral leadership is a key to effectively carrying out communicants classes, that as pastors, we need to be significantly involved in that part of disciple making in our church membership, in our church members, and in our children's lives. So that was one of the key things that we felt like a communicants class ought to start with. Ed's going to take the next one and go from there.
Student participation is got to be there, and when we say that, we don't just mean that you got to have kids signed up for a communicants class. That's obvious, but I'm sure you've learned that just standing up before a group of students or anybody and lecturing to them or taking them through a material is not sufficient for them to learn. And communicants classes are not just about regurgitating facts. We're talking about evaluating the heart. What's going on in their souls? Do they know the Lord and Savior that we want to know that they know before we admit them to the table? And so getting them involved, highly participating in what's going on, we found that that a very interactive class, in whatever format that comes, that may be a lot of discussion. It may be that you simply come in and ask good questions and let them carry a lot of the weight of the discussion. It may be that you provide them with a lot of worksheets and things where they're actually having to engage the materials. But you know, educational models, and there's experts that can spit off statistics about how much more effective it is for somebody to write than just to hear, and for them to be multiply sensory involved in their learning. So, you know, participation is key because of the stakes that are at hand, and because it helps them to get this material so much more effectively and thoroughly. So, student participation is crucial.
Our next little piece of the puzzle there is parental involvement. We're talking about covenant children here as our major focus. And we can entertain some questions and some discussion about what do you do with children who are not covenant children, who may be a part of the body in some way and that kind of thing in a few minutes. But just as you focus on the needs of covenant children, most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the doorpost command, with Deuteronomy 6:4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words which I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them. When, as my cheaters here are a little steamy from the walk-in from the parking lot. Anyway, you shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, and when you lie down and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. And you shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. You know, as Moses gave these commands to the people of Israel, he was talking about living before our children our faith, about transferring the things that God had done to the next generation. And parental involvement is a key. Everybody knows that parents have a major impact in their children's lives today. We want to honor that principle. One of the things that Ed and I struggled with, particularly when we first started talking about what to do with community classes, was that traditionally the model has been that when little Johnny gets to be 10 or 12 or whatever the age is, you throw them in a class and they join the church. But parents aren't involved in that process. They take little Johnny, they drop him off, and after class, little Johnny and his peers run out and they all do their thing, and then eventually they stand before the session and they articulate some of the things that they've been taught and they go. And the materials that were available at that point were pretty much geared for that kind of a process. We felt like it denied one of our core values as Presbyterians, that it really denied covenant theology, that we really believe that parents ought to have a major role, responsibility, and opportunity to lead their children to Christ. We also believe that there are other elements that have to come about, that sessions need to take responsibility to be sure that those who make those professions of faith as they come have an understanding of the gospel. And we'll talk some more about that. So anyway, those are some of the things that were driving us as we kind of launched and got started with the idea. Ed?
Right. So pastoral leadership, student participation, parental involvement, and then, of course, the thing that we're looking for is that they know the gospel, right? The requirement, the only requirement that we ask of our members, whether they be very young or very old, is that they know the gospel. And we may hope for other things. We may expect other things in addition to that, in terms of knowledge, in terms of evidence of discipleship, and that sort of thing. But any good communicants class is going to have the gospel as its central focus. Now, One of the things that that I've encountered, maybe you've encountered this, is that we sometimes will impose on our children expectation for evidencing the faith that many of the adults in our congregation couldn't meet. You know, a standard where, you know, I've got an almost 7-year-old son who has repeatedly professed his faith to me, and yet every now and then my wife and I will say, well, can we really trust that profession of faith because he's demonstrating such sinful attitudes? And I need to look at myself and say, well, wait a minute. How often am I demonstrating sinful attitudes as a pastor? And they're not excommunicating me. And so we've got to be very careful, I think, in a good communicants class, good communicants approach, not just to the class, but to the communicants themselves, is to remember and understand that what we're looking for is a profession of faith in the gospel. We want to see evidence of discipleship, of course. We want to see them being active in the church, of course. We want to see them demonstrating growth in grace. Of course we want all of those things. But a gospel focus in a communicants program, to me, means that we have a reasonable expectation of their ability as young disciples, right? These are early stage disciples at best. As young disciples, what are our expectations of them? And are we setting the bar higher for them just because they're children of the church than we are for many of the adults in our congregation? That's something I want to be very careful about with my communicants. And we wanted to urge you all to reconsider also, as these are reconsiderations that we might think through together. So the gospel focus has got to be there. That's got to be the center of the materials. You know, of course we want to have our students learning the catechism. Those are incredibly valuable tools. But when our communicants class becomes about how many catechism questions can you recite, then we've lost sight of simply looking for the profession of faith that is simply required by Christ himself before we would be admitted to come to him. So let's be careful that we don't impose on them standards beyond what the gospel itself requires, beyond what the scriptures itself requires. That said, there are some other things that we want to make sure we include in a communicants class.
Yeah, as much as we want to focus on the gospel, we think that theological introduction is important, is critical to meaningful church membership. You know, if you've made a profession of faith, there are some basic core things that you need to understand about this God that you're worshiping. You know, you need to talk about some of those principles that we hold dear that will help your children be able to articulate their faith in a meaningful way other than just saying, I love Jesus. When we do a new members class, what do we expect of our new members? Just typically an adult new members class. We usually take them through what? We take them through the gospel. And then you look at the vows that you take as a new church member, and you make commitments to the worship and work of the local church. You make commitments to having a clear understanding of your faith and your commitment to Christ. And so we think that there's some core things that need to be taught in a good communicants class, just like in a good new members class. Now, we may not talk about the nuances of infant baptism, but we ought to be able to teach our children what it means that they have been baptized. And we ought to talk about the Lord's Supper. We ought to talk about some of the key doctrines that we hold dear as Presbyterians, and even maybe an introduction to covenant theology. You know, Daddy, why is there an Old Testament and a New Testament? Were the people in the Old Testament saved different than the people in the New Testament? You ought to be able to answer those questions for your children in such a way that they can understand the cohesive message of the gospel, Old Testament, New Testament. So we think those are part of what need to be done, not in a G.I. Williamson commentary way on the Westminster Confession and shorter and larger catechisms, but in a very principial basis. We do believe that the catechisms are of great value and can be a great assistance, but there's got to be more than just a recitation of information. There's got to be kind of a heart value. Those kinds of instruction can take place very easily in a communicants class, and we want to urge that as an element in what we do. Ed, you want to step up to the next one there?
Yeah, in addition to introducing them to theology, we want to introduce them to what the church means. What does it mean that they're joining a Presbyterian church? One of the things that's such a value to me of our Presbyterianism is that in its structure, in its connection, in its government and the accountability and oversight and love and shepherding that being a Presbyterian represents, that's a wonderful and beautiful thing. It's not something that we ought to be ashamed of or shy away from simply because we're dealing with younger members and potential members of the church. We need to be careful, I think, when it comes to theology, when it comes to church structure, of assuming that young students either can't understand these things or that they don't care about them. Don't be mistaken that your kids don't care about what an elder is and what he does. My 5-year-old daughter has been asking me about that. She's asking pointed questions about, Daddy, what's an elder? Why are there elders? Why are you an elder but you don't do the same thing as the other elders? These are astute questions, which shows me that a 5-year-old is able to at least begin to get some of these concepts. And we ought to therefore offer some answers to those concepts in our communicants classes. They don't have to read the Book of Church Order through in order to get that introduction. But to give them an introduction and an offering of what does it mean for them to be Presbyterian, it's only fair, isn't it, that we're asking them to join a church that we ought to tell them what membership in that church means. Right? If you were joining your Rotary Club, then you would want to know what the requirements for membership were, not just what standard you had to meet in order to qualify, but what kind of expectations would be put on you, what sort of involvement there would be asked of you. And so church structure, how our churches are governed, what the offices do, how they fit into that, those are very valuable things to introduce in a communicants class, just like they are in an adult members class.
Yeah, we really almost view the communicants class as a primer for a church membership class, on that kind of a level. And one of the things you want to do when you receive new members into your church is you want them to integrate into the body. You want them to be a part of the body and to use their gifts and to use their abilities, even if they're children, to be a part of serving Christ and those kind of things. We once heard an elder say something along these lines, talking about the importance of youth ministry. He said, we have to minister to them because they're the church of tomorrow. And that's true. But they're the church of today as well. When we receive communicants into the church, they are part of the body of Christ in a very real way. And I think we need to honor that by the way we do our communicants classes. That we need to give them the opportunity to use their gifts, whatever they may be. They're just emerging, they're just developing, they're just growing into those things. So we really do believe that when our children go through whatever kind of communicants class you do, whether you use the traditional approach that we've used in the church for the last 30, 40 years, or whether you take another approach with it, that there ought to be an element of integration where they are included in the active work of the church. And that says something about the way we structure our ministries as a whole, I think. We really ought to view our communicants class as a launching pad for our children to get involved and to be a part of what we're doing.
Which means that we've got to be ready to receive them when they're ready to join the church. And this is something that I mentioned even just in the introductory words, that has always been a problem, a stumbling block, I think, in churches, is at what age do we admit children to membership? It's always a sticky point, sticky point, isn't it? Because we don't want to set the age so low that we've undercut the likelihood that they'll even have cognitive understanding and true heart awareness of the gospel. At the other end, we don't want to be so arbitrary about it that younger children who still have a valid profession of faith are not admitted to the sacraments and given the full benefits of the membership in the kingdom that they ought to have as professing members. I've known children at very young ages, 5 and 6, that professed faith, and their profession of faith was articulate. It showed clear evidence in their life. There was every reason to believe that. And as they grew up, I've seen those children grow up into that faith. I've also seen teenagers who professed faith, and in no way did I have any reason to believe that profession was genuine. They just didn't seem to evidence any understanding of the gospel itself, let alone any growth in grace. And so that showed us, when we were thinking through this initially, and as we've continued to think through this through the years, we've got to have flexibility with admission age. And so a good communicants class program, a good communicants approach, will include some measure of flexibility. I was talking with a guy from my presbytery a few weeks ago about he had a family that the dad came to him and said, I think he's ready. You know, I think he's ready to join the church, and I want to go ahead and move ahead with that. And it happened to be that this young fellow that the dad thought was ready, several of his friends had joined the church, and so he's kind of feeling that peer pressure, right? That all my friends are joining, and so maybe I should too. And my pastor friend began to ask this father about, you know, why do you think he's ready, and what evidence have you seen, and what has he said, and what are you hearing, and that sort of thing. And my friend said, you know, that's okay. You know, if you want to move ahead with this, then I think we're ready. That's okay. But here's the thing. When he goes on a youth retreat with our junior high leader and begins to talk about how he's not sure he believes any of this stuff, are you going to be ready then for us to excommunicate him?
It wasn't me that said that, by the way.
And of course, the dad said, wait a minute, I don't think I'm ready for that, right? And that's just illustrating the point. We sometimes rush into it, and other times we hold back. And so flexibility, this is one of the hardest things to do in the whole process, is to say, how do we have flexibility for that? One of the things that we can do to alleviate that, though, is to offer the way that we instruct in a more variable way.
Yeah, and that's really, isn't that the struggle? I mean, you've got a group of kids, and you know, they're not all exactly the same age, unless you're in a 1,000-member church. You've got a spectrum of ages, a spectrum of learning abilities, learning skills, and those kind of things. So as Ed and I were struggling, and you've got to know that the way this, our piece of curriculum that we have designed came about was because we were struggling with these kind of issues. You know, we were struggling with how do we really make this effective. We had a group of kids, and the age span was 5 years old to 10 years old or 11 years old. I don't remember exactly how many kids we had, but we had a number of kids. And how do we teach 10-year-olds and 5-year-olds in an effective way at the same time in a pastor's class or something like that? And so out of that need to offer some age variability, some ability to meet needs, not just age, but learning abilities and those kind of things as well, we began to say, where's the responsibility lie? Does the responsibility lie on the session and on the pastor to do this training for our covenant children? And the answer is yes, it does. But it also primarily lies on the parent, on the father in particular, and on dads as they would disciple their children. And so what are we doing as a church, you know, as we're thinking through these issues, to help dads, to equip moms, to disciple their children and prepare them for meaningful church membership? That solves your problem. If it's done in the home, homeschooling has been on the rise for a long time. It fits with the direction our culture has made. And so we thought maybe we should not reinvent the wheel so much as shift the way we go about the process. But then you've got the other question. If mom and dad are doing all the work of teaching their children, then how do we know that what they're getting is what they need? And so we needed to create a way to follow up, to review. But there's another benefit that flows out of that kind of an approach, isn't there? Because if you're teaching something, what are you doing before you teach it? You're learning that material, you're reviewing that material, you're getting it into your heart and head. And all of a sudden we went, look at the beauty of the covenant. Look at the beauty of the way God has designed the family and the church to function. And aren't we doing as pastors exactly what Christ has called us to do? We're making disciples. We're discipling moms and dads so that they can disciple their children, so that they will understand the faith once delivered to the saints. So we thought that maybe there ought to be a different approach, but we also know that if you do anything, that you need to test it. And so that really leads to the number 10 in the pieces of the puzzle here.
Well, that and also the fact that, you know, when you know, our Book of Church Order requires that the last step, of course, is that they come before the elders. Now, in our church, ours is not a big church. The elders are well known. And yet, anybody who's asked to appear before the elders as an adult is quaky, right? So you can imagine how intimidating it must be for a child, especially maybe a younger child, maybe 7 or 8, and they've been excited about their faith, but still a little bit unsure, and maybe they've had mixed receptions. You know, their Sunday school teacher has been very encouraging, their parents have. And so we've got to, the last step, so to speak, in testing that and evaluating them and helping them in their path toward church membership is being very intentional about the way we ask them to interact with the elders. And we've come up with probably a dozen different ideas of some things we can do, but it could be as simple as things like, you know, meet with them in the children's classroom where you can all sit at eye level, rather than having them come into the boardroom and sit in a chair that swallows them. You know, sit with them in a place where they're comfortable. Just send a couple of elders. You know, at our church then, we have commissioned a team of 2 or 3 elders to meet with one child at a time instead of having them come before the whole session in a formal session meeting. And they go in and they just sit down with the kids, you know, making eye contact with them, asking questions that help them, not that are leading questions, but that help them know what kind of things they need to be giving us information about. Being affirming, not correcting them. You know, all of these are things that we can do just very intentionally and getting on board with your session and saying, these are some things that everybody needs to be keeping in mind as we're going through this process. And let's be intentional together, because we don't want the kid to freeze up simply because they're intimidated, and to give the misimpression that the faith that they really do have genuinely isn't there. So being intentional about the way that we ask them to interview with the elders is a key thing. That kind of rounds out 10 ideas. But obviously all of these ideas have their outworkings and lots of different implications too. So,
One of the things that your elders always need to do and you want them to do is to not just kind of be the bar that the children have to cross before they can join church membership, but to have the opportunity to, in a loving and gentle way, encourage the students that are coming and encourage families and shepherd those families. One of the things that we did with the piece of material that we've produced, and we really don't want to be an infomercial, but one of the things that we've done is we've designed the curriculum that we put in your hand there to give the parents 6 lessons. And I'm not going to even say 6 weeks, because I think that typically our experience has been that with older children, you can probably walk through that in 6 weeks very easily as part of your family devotion time. But then it's followed up with 3 weeks of review. I don't know about you. I look at something 2 or 3 or 5 or 20 times before I've got it. I'm not the fastest draw in the shootout, you know. And so I need to review. I need to think back through those things. So as we designed the materials that we thought we would test and try in our local congregations, Ed and I said, why don't we set it up so that we have an opportunity for an elder or for a pastor to sit down with, you know, one child, five children, and review what they've done with their children. So we set this material up. As you look in the introduction pages there, 6 weeks or six classes of instruction, and then 3 weeks of review, where you basically cover the same ground again and have the opportunity to hear where little Johnny is with Christ and how his understanding is growing, and to get to know those children before they come before session two. And that takes a lot of the fear and a lot of the sting out of that. So those are our top 10, and I guess at this point, just open up for any questions,
yeah, are there
or
any questions?
Comments or whatever, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, we encountered that twice at the church that we worked together at, and I've encountered that at other churches too. I think
me
Richard
too.
Has as well. You know what we did that we found the most effective was, you know, we had one kid in particular who just was a stray. I mean, he didn't have hardly any parental involvement in his life whatsoever, let alone spiritual parental involvement. And so we paired him up with a godly family, and we gave him an elder and a deacon and a family that would just kind of attend to him and got him included in the covenant life that he obviously always wanted to have because he's coming to the church and he's eager for that. And we, with the permission of his real parents,
that was going to be my follow-up.
There you got
with the
it.
Permission of his real parents,
yeah.
We allowed the family that we had paired him up with and the elder who we had asked to oversee to walk him through the same material. And they did the same thing that they would if it was for their own child. And they loved him and embraced him in that way.
Now, Ed, you did that as a youth director too, didn't you?
Right, with, that's right. Yeah, I did that personally with
the kid across the street from you?
Yeah, with Travis.
Yeah,
right.
Travis. I couldn't remember his name.
Right.
And I've had that instance happen more than once where either there was already a natural relationship with the youth director that had brought that child into the fellowship in some way, and that youth director worked with them. Travis, Ed's neighbor that he worked with from across the street, was a beautiful illustration of the way God can use those kind of relationships, and made it easy to do that. And I had a youth pastor whose name was Travis, not the same guy, but who was really, really good at coming alongside those children. Mm-hmm. And made that transition into the life of the body very meaningful, very significant for the mm-hmm. teen, so young teen.
Did we cover your follow-up as well?
Yeah, the only other thing would be what has your experience been on those with those parents? Were they willing to do that?
They were willing to let, in my experience, they were willing to let, you know, little Johnny or Travis go through the material, join the church, be a part of the church. They would visit the church, and there was an interest in what was going on because they were seeing the changes taking place in their child, but we haven't seen them, to my knowledge, come to faith since then, but it's an opportunity. So,
yeah, in my experience, I've only encountered one family where the parents were actually not just even suspicious, but they were kind of aggressively anti-church. But here's what happened is that the family that had embraced the kid that was coming to our church, it was a girl in that case, and the elder that had kind of taken her on as his shepherding project and that sort of thing, they just began to invest in relationships with that family. And it was a patient thing. You know, this is kind of part of that age flexibility or, you know, and requirement. We're not saying, okay, she's 13, she's got to be joining the church because she's coming around. We're saying when the relational context, when the spiritual context, all of that is ready, then we'll move ahead. And over time, then that family didn't come to faith, But their skepticism and their aggression toward the church ebbed. And it was because of the loving relationships that they saw members of this church having with their daughter. And the way that they saw their daughter, who they loved. I mean, don't mistake that atheistic and aggressively anti-Christian families don't also love their kids. You know, they loved their daughter. And they loved that there were other adults who took genuine care and not just some sort of a weird adult-child relationship thing, but really genuine care and interest in their daughter.
So good question, though, Larry.
Yeah, just as a follow-up to that question, you spoke about how the relationships really bridge the gap mm-hmm. for the non-Christian family. Can you talk about some other ways to bridge that gap with unchurched families, the idea of a communicants class with unchurched families, or families that are from a Protestant background, say Baptist background or something like that?
Right. Same view of membership. Yeah, that's a good question.
You know, it's the same approach, you basically give to the child the opportunity to work with someone who's willing to invest in discipling that child. You know, if they're ready to be a part of that kind of thing, then pair them up with somebody who's ready. That's where we as pastors and elders take on shepherding roles and discipling roles with our children coming into the church. So it works the same way, if I'm understanding the question.
Yeah. And this also comes back to, you know, how well can you articulate just in general why membership is valuable? You know, if you don't have a good answer to that question, then you're not going to be able to convince adults who have been attending church all their lives to join your church. But if you can articulate to adults, church membership is valuable because of these things, and begin to walk them through, this is what church membership really is about, then even an unbelieving parent whose child is interested in joining the church will say, okay, well, that's what you need to do then. Maybe not readily, but eventually, that's been our experience, is that they do come around. They understand it.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
So that with the 6-year-old, we're not looking for a 25-year-old's profession of faith.
That's so true.
For a 14-year, you know, and some of our elders get that through their own experience in terms of fathering.
Right.
And so they've worked through that, but others haven't had that experience. And so, you know, what kinds of things have you found helpful to equip and coach and train your elders to know what we're looking for based on where the person is developmentally?
Well, one of the things that we've done with our elders is talk about how profession of faith is not so subjective as we want to make it in our culture, our evangelical culture. You know, we want to make it all about how powerful is your testimony, which makes those of us who have a not very powerful testimony feel like maybe our faith isn't genuine. But really, it's about the objective truths that we've embraced. And our Book of Church Order articulates this very clearly, that if you can answer these five sets of questions.
If you can take these five vows.
Yeah, if you can take these five vows, then you are effectively professing your faith. And so in our church, then what we've done is we've actually reworded those questions into sets of questions that are broken down for child-based, you know, age-based kind of friendliness. Some of those are very long questions. They're long enough that we feel the need to re-ask the "do you" part at the end, right? because by the time you get to the end of that, then it's for the people that have been being asked that, adults have forgotten that this is a "do you" question, right? So we want to make sure they know that the answer is "I do" and not "I think so" or "yes" or whatever. So for a 7-year-old or a 10-year-old, we shouldn't expect them to follow those long questions if we don't even expect our adults to. And so what we did was we broke especially the longer questions down into several questions that cover the same content. This is one reason, by the way, why I think that the BCO amendment that has been voted on over the last year is actually a pretty good idea, because it gives us flexibility with the way that we deal with various ages and doesn't make us rigidly adhere to that set of questions. I'm not suggesting, I'm not politicking for anybody on a floor vote today or anything, but I'm just saying,
right.
I think it's a conversation worth having because of the fact that I think that age variability is something that needs to be accommodated, even in the way that we ask them to articulate their faith. But that's the best way that I've found, is to ask them questions that are, they're not leading questions. They're just objective questions that say, do you believe this?
The other element to that, too, is when they come before a session for membership, if you can have them come with their parent who has walked with them through some sort of a material and learning process, the ability to articulate what they believe really is enhanced for a child. And so that kind of solves some of those problems, too.
Okay. Well, I think one of the values of what we've put together is that it can start at any time. And actually, I've found it easier not to have everybody start at once and try to end at once.
Yeah, we tried starting a class at once, all of them at once, and it was overwhelming because we had children who were working with parents, and you know, we had some parents who were saying, let's work through this, and we're going to do a lesson a week, and we're going to get all the way through this, and in 6 weeks we'll be ready to meet with you and, you know, review and all that. And then we had other parents who said, you know, this is probably going to take us 12 weeks to work through.
Yeah.
And so we had people all over the map, and that was chaos, you know, in terms of just orchestrating those kind of things. So what you do, what we did after, Ed and I have tested this for,
years.
I don't know, 10 years. So we've played around with this and how to do this. We've kind of I learned best the hard way anyway, so what can I say? What we did was, I was in a church with about 250 members or so before moving to Florida. And we had a good number of children who were of communicant age and that kind of thing. So what we did was we said to the families, we said, we're going to launch a new communicants class this fall. And we'd like to have a meeting during the Sunday school hour, you know, the second Sunday in September or whatever date it was, introduce to you the material that we'd like to use, and we want you and little Johnny to come to meet with this class. And we're going to put everything in your hand that you need, and we're going to pat you on the head and launch you out. And then we want you to come back to us after you've been through the material and had a chance to work through it. We also said to them at that time, now, we know that this is a new thing for you to do, that you've probably never done this kind of a material, this kind of thing on your own. And so we are here for you. Over this process of the next 6, 9, 12 weeks, whatever it takes you, and we will answer any questions, we will support, we will provide materials or whatever you need to complete the process. And once you're satisfied that little Johnny has a grasp of the content of the gospel and of meaningful church membership, then we'll arrange to meet with you or have an elder meet with you. That worked very, very well. In my context now, it seems to work even better that it just kind of happens as parents sense that their children are ready to join the church. I actually think we have, David, three people who are in the process, three families who are in the process of working through this material with their children, and who will, in due time, be interviewed and join the church. Last family that came through were the Rennicks. They completed it, and Bill is one of our elders. Bill, were you there the night Kathleen came to the session? What do you remember anything about her testimony before the session? Now, Kathleen's an exceptional student to begin with. I got to tell you this. But it blew us away. And Kathleen is how old, David? Going into fifth grade.
Coming back to a timeline question, though, one of the things that is a risk that you're taking when you put something in parents' hands and say, y'all do this at your own pace,
yeah.
is it's never going to get done. You know, and there's value in giving that kind of flexibility, because certain personalities, I mean, I've worked with families that they knocked it out, and you know, these were the kind of homeschool families that they got a year's worth of school done in 6 months, right? And so they got the thing done in 4 weeks, and were ready to review it. And I've worked with other families that took a year. And one of the ways that I've tried to accommodate that at our church is that we've already got our congregation divided up among our elders for shepherding purposes anyway. And so we just make sure that when we meet with the family the first time to give them an orientation to what we're going to be doing, that shepherding elder that's their elder is there with them, and that he has an idea of what they're going to be doing and when they've started, and he follows up regularly, just checking in on them. Do they have any questions? How has it been going? Have they encountered difficulties? Are there resources that the church could provide to the family to answer questions that they've been having? And the elders then make part of their shepherding duty the seeing through of the covenant family. And isn't that really what they're there for anyway? So, here again, I've just tried to take what we already have in place and what we already believe to be the right order of doing things and make that a way to keep accountability going for this kind of a process. That still means that in some cases that students don't finish it for a year. And in some cases, I think this is one of the values
absolutely
of this. In some cases, they decide, we're not ready for this. And the parents and students together say, let's wait a year or two. Let's wait until that profession of faith really is there. That's why the first part of the book is, what is the gospel? And how do you, as a student, articulate your belief in the gospel? How do you proclaim your faith? So, I don't think that there's any harm in letting those students that are not ready to profess faith slide for another year or two and then come back to them after a while. But, there again, make sure your elders are doing good follow-up and say, okay, they've decided they're going to step back. So Jim or Roy, I want you to put on your calendar 6 months from now, a year from now, some note that will remind you to follow up with them and ask them, have they checked in lately with their student to find out if there's been any progress in their faith?
It gives mom and dad the opportunity to lead their child of faith, to disciple their child as a new believer if that child makes a profession while they're working together, or to say, I don't believe that little Johnny's ready to join the church. Yeah. And who's going to know better? Is it going to be the youth director or the pastor or the elder, or is it going to be mom and dad? So, yeah.
Follow up on the other side of that. Mom and dad are convinced Johnny's ready. Okay? And you're not. And that's what we found has been much
the most difficult part.
So how do you deal with that?
It's an elder's role, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I see you're going to let me take this one first.
Well, I'll take it. I think that the way you deal with that is you say, as the elders of the church, as a session, you say to mom and dad, we think that, Freddie needs to wait a little while before he joins the church. We don't believe that we see a clear enough profession of faith. And you want to do that as gently and as kindly as you can. And you need to say, if we feel like he's ready in 3 months, we'll be glad to entertain that again. But it has to be done. And, we can't just, because a child reaches the age of accountability, rubber stamp them into church membership, which is what certainly led to the demise of previous denominations and was a very unhealthy way to go about doing the church. I raised a bunch of questions that way, didn't I?
Yeah. can I throw in my two cents before we follow up on that? I'd say, thank you, a quarter. It's worth a quarter these days. I'd say, on the one hand, my friend's response to a family that thought the kid was ready, while probably more frank than most of us would be ready to be, I think is a good approach to say, look, this is not something to enter into casually. And, if your kid isn't ready to join the church and they join anyway, not only is that, lowering their view of church membership and devaluing something that we ought to all value more highly than we do anyway, but it's also opening a context where they're gonna be expected certain things of them. You know, if they profess that they're more skeptical than their membership should suggest, then we're gonna have to act on that. And so, you know, not in a threatening kind of a way, but just in a didactic kind of a way to come alongside them and say, you know, this is what the logical consequences of somebody joining the church when they're not ready to join the church will be. On the other hand, I think this also comes back to we've got to be ready to give benefit of the doubt, and we don't do that well as Presbyterians. We just don't. We are highly skeptical of anybody that doesn't say things exactly the way that we do. And that's true at General Assemblies. It's also true when it's kids coming to profess their faith. And so we've got to be more pastoral about the way that we approach kids that way. We've got to be more ready to say, you know, that's not exactly the way I would articulate the faith, but I hear the faith in that. And we have to have ears to hear and prayerfully and optimistically listening for that. Now, that's not to say that there aren't going to be some times when your scenario is real and right. And that's when we fall back to, I think, just being very instructive about the importance and value of church membership.
Mick, yeah. Sue?
That's painful, and one of the beauties of this is that if you have an elder shepherding this family, then right. You know before you get to that.
Exactly.
Yeah, I would say there's at least four stages where somebody will have heard their testimony and had a chance to address whether, because it starts with the parent. And if the parent's convinced, then you've got that shepherding elder involved. And then there's this review that they're going to come in, and part of that process is, I want to hear your testimonies. Tell me what you believe. And it becomes a time for me to just get excited about hearing from kids what they believe. But it also gives me opportunity to follow up one-on-one with them and with their parents and say,
Let's
is what I'm hearing.
What
I heard you say was this, and that raises this question for me. Can you answer that? Again, approaching it optimistically, not expecting that because they said the wrong thing or they said the right thing in a wrong way, that they obviously are not believers. But going back to them and saying, can you give me a little bit more? Can you help me understand why you said it this way? And then finally, it gets to the elders. If you're shepherding folks through this process, and it's not just a, you know, check off that you've attended X number of classes, but it really is a process of getting them involved and highly interactive and that kind of thing, there shouldn't be a context where they get all the way to the time when they're going to meet with the elders for their kind of official profession of faith, and they fall on their face.
Yeah.
That just shouldn't be the case. We've done a poor job of shepherding them through the communicants process if it goes that far.
Yeah. Mary, go ahead.
I love this because parents already feel like they're an expert in where their child is.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really giving them the ability to do that well. They already feel that way. Have you ever worked with families who feel like, well, this is something new, we never used to have to do this, this is a little like...
Sure.
Yeah, my whole, our experience has been that that's always the first response. Well, we've never done it that way before. You know, those are the famous last words of the church. That's always a response. And we always say, you know, the heart of what we're offering here, the heart of what we're doing is really not so much rooted in what we've done before, but in the biblical idea of the covenant family.
Yeah.
And I like to drive it back to the doorpost command in Deuteronomy 6 to family responsibility. And that is so popular. I mean, it's just a natural thing for our society today,
right,
with the rise of homeschooling and all those kind of things. It's almost a natural for those kind of families. And then other families seem to understand that
right,
just as well.
Yeah. I agree. One thing I'll add to that, too, is I also want to come back to the idea of not invalidating what has been done before.
Yeah.
And being careful to say, you know, that's great that y'all have done that before, but our session has tried to do better than what we've done before. Not that what we've done before wasn't good, but we're trying to perfect, right? We're trying
to
improve our practices and our ministry, and we believe as a session that this is a good next step for our church to take.
At last.
That's a great question that's come up in my church a lot because, frankly, in the congregation I pastor, then the elders are very nervous about voting because of turmoil in the past. I mean, there have been very political votes, and almost to the point where membership is not essentially about the gospel. It's not essentially about are we community and taking the sacraments together. But in some contexts, then membership is about who's got the power, right? So here's what we've done is to say, look, just because a 7-year-old or a 15-year-old is professing their faith doesn't mean that we now treat them like a full-blown adult. They're still under the authority of their parents. And therefore, we still expect them to follow the authority of their parents. And what we do is we encourage parents of the very young children, just encourage them to abstain from voting. That, you know, if they don't know what's going on, then they ought not vote. That's the truth for all of us, right? So we encourage our parents of young children to discourage their children from voting. That's not really why the kids want to join the church, y'all. They don't care about the vote. They want to take the sacrament because they've been taught well that the sacrament is the means of grace, and they profess faith and want that.
Yeah.
So they don't care about the vote. For the older children, then it's giving the parents the context of guidance for help them learn how to vote responsibly. But here's the other side of that. If we begin to now impose on membership, can they vote articulately? We've got to go. I mean, I've got 80-year-old members that have waged poor votes in my congregation. Should I excommunicate them? We've added a standard to the membership, haven't we? That's wrong.
Yeah.
Last fall, we took nominations for elder, and we had one guy who got several nominations that, he's been a deacon for 20 years now and he's earned his right to be an elder. Well, he is actually a pretty good candidate for elder, but that's not the reason, right? Should I take that nomination as invalid and should I discount that person's view ever in voting because they're not making an articulate expression of, you know, being reasonable and thoughtful and biblical in the reasons why they make their votes?
Can you tell that's a hot button for Ed?
Actually, well, it's just been very recent.
Actually, you know, we're probably going to see some of that on the floor in a little while, aren't we? Anyway.
I don't know.
Does that answer your question? I had another session who literally said, well, we'll be glad to receive younger children, but we're not going to allow them to vote until they reach a certain age. And I've seen that happen as well. I'm not comfortable with that personally, but being the moderator of the session, that being passed as a bylaw that we would abide by, I submitted my brothers in that. But so there is another way to handle that if they're worried about voting.
Sure.
That hasn't happened in our situation here.
And there are also state things having to do with corporate.
With corporate documents and all that. Yeah. Oh yeah. We got working through all those things. So. Other questions? What's our time?
Yeah, we're this guy's is going to have to be the last one, I think.
Clarification on the timeline. You said you've obviously got a time where you orient the parents to the curriculum, train,
do their thing, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Then you have review sessions. That's a class format.
You can do it either way. You can do it either.
I would say yes.
Yeah, the answer is yes. You can do it either way. You can do it, you can limit it, to a classroom time. I like to have mom and dad and the child there, or mom or dad and the child there, to do it together that way. I prefer more one-on-one just because that's what I prefer.
Yeah, I've found the one-on-one is more effective, in part because every kid is going to have different areas where they're stronger and weaker.
Especially when you start talking about testimony. That can take a while sometimes. Even if I was to ask you to articulate your testimony now, that usually brings emotion and those kind of things too. So sometimes it's easier to do in a one-on-one setting too. So,
listen, we want to invite y'all to visit a website where we've got some of the stuff that you that is available this morning up there for free. So if you wanted to make extra copies or send it to folks,
yeah,
we've got some other things that are up there that are for free. And then if you're interested in ordering our curriculum, then on the back of the little notes page that we provided, then there's a discount code on there as
have
a thank you all for attending our
for
seminar
you.
Code. We'll give you 20% off for the rest of this calendar year on as many copies as you want to order.
You want to talk about the price on that?
We've priced it at $9.99 or $10 for the student's book and $11 for the parent's book. But again, with the discount, then that's going to be less. But
do you have a plan to make an elder's book?
We do.
We're actually in conversation about that, and we've also got a plan to do a similar thing for just regular members classes, for adult member classes. That would be really easy to port a lot of the stuff into an adult class context. The same principles hold, where they're going to learn it better if it's interactive, if they have some hands-on involvement, if they have something to take home, but that isn't just a, okay, read chapters 10 through 33 before next Sunday or whatever.
Yeah, do check out the website. There's some resources
there. Yeah, keep
tabs
on us, and we'll be adding more stuff like that down the line.
Yeah, you can always call one of us or whatever. And
sure.
We'll follow up. Y'all, thank you for being here this
Thanks
morning.
Thanks very much.
And if you've got any other questions, just catch us, and we'll be glad to talk about it, talk it through.
Yeah, we'll be hanging around for a little while.
Thanks. Good job. Thanks. Good job.